that have relatively low levels, very low levels of violence, and only three or four that have relatively high levels of violence, one of them being Baghdad, where a high proportion of all of it takes place.
General Casey acknowledged about an hour ago that some of the Iraqi army troops did not show up for battle. In other words, according to one NPR embedded reporter, most of a battalion of 500 disappeared over the past week. What does this tell us about the future of Iraq if these troops are going to be defending the country? And is this a significant problem or an isolated problem there?
I would characterize it as an isolated problem. They did well in Najaf. They did well in Samarra. They did well in the peninsula yesterday. And there have been instances where they have not done so well. So it seems to me that that's not surprising. You know, the easy thing to do is to recruit people and equip people and train them. Those are all things that you can develop a metric on and track, and you can see what's happening. The hard stuff is developing non-commissioned officers and junior officers and senior leadership and key officials in the Ministry of Interior and the Ministry of Defense. Those are the soft things that you don't have metrics for. How good is morale? How good is leadership? And that's a problem. It's a problem with any new unit. It's a problem with any units that have a mixture of people who haven't worked together intimately and haven't developed the kind of confidence you develop over time. So I think what one ought to expect that from time to time we're going to see this type of thing. And on the other hand, there have been some commando units and some riot control elements and some regular Iraqi forces and police forces that have done a very good job.
You want to come in on that?
Well, no, I've only say that he also, as I recall, General Casey also said there might have been some just purely administrative reasons why that might have happened as well. So that'll all be looked into. But I agree exactly with the Secretary that the harder things to do are to get the leadership in place that causes people to perform the way they do, and that's being worked on.
Okay. Last April in the battle for Fallujah.
Shut up. This nonsense about the harder thing to do is get good leadership in place in Iraq. What's the hardest thing for you to do in Iraq is keep your puppet Iraqi leadership Nimrods alive, because they keep getting their ass shot off. That's the hard thing to do. And then you babble out. For elections and stability, it is necessary for Sam's invasion into Fallujah. And for the independence of the Iraqi people, it's necessary that American G.I. Joe soldiers keep getting their head shot off by you know who, the Iraqi resistance. And then you babble out how the Iraqi police are running for cover and trading sides is an isolated incident. Well, if that's the case, Rumsfeld, why don't you, Boy George, Condoleezza Rice, Powell, and Cheney use the Iraqi Security Force police as your personal bodyguard protection? One thing's for sure, it'll be good for my head coughing business. And you'll be the first candidate. You know what time it is. Slave revolt time. Check this out. You're listening to 104.1. 106.7, Illinois. Freak Radio Berkeley, Santa Cruz. LUBER.com, the world, and RadioForAll.net, the universe, Slave Revolt Time. Tonight, we're going to shoot our way into a Beyond the Shadow segment as we'll deal with how liberals need to get off their knees. Look, you're not going to pray or hocus pocus your way out of this. And trying to appeal to silly Americans who are on their knees chanting to some invisible man is not the solution. You know what time it is. Slave Revolt Time. Check it out.
I will, however, spare the unfortunate author in selecting for a topic that Nixon years, our author shows a stunning naivete. Now, none of you are old enough to remember, as I do, how Nixon's countrymen betrayed him. But was Richard Nixon really to blame? No. He was a target, a victim. Campus radical needed a scapegoat to justify their own shoddy idealism. Mr. Hazard, you appear to be writhing in your seat. Is this a nervous condition?
Why, yes, it is. It's a nervous condition.
What?
No. No, it's not a nervous condition.
Oh.
Mrs. Billings, I don't mean to be rude, but no one destroyed President Nixon. The man destroyed himself. The secret bombings in Cambodia. He rigged a presidential election. The media didn't create that. He put it down on tape.
You're not old enough to know who did what. That's my job. And one thing I will not have in my classroom is anarchy.
Anarchy? The man lied. He resigned a disgrace. I mean, is it anarchy to discuss the facts?
Mr. Hauser, this is my classroom. I decide what are and are not facts. You, sir, are in my class. Please sit down.
Mrs. Billings, we're all adults here. I mean, you seem like a fairly reasonable person. I mean, really, is it your class or is it our class?
Our class, Dick Brain.
Sean? I didn't expect to see you back in here so soon.
Everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
You know what time it is. Beyond the Shadow. And tonight, what we're going to start off with is how basically liberals are on their little knees and are actually yapping about what to do next since the so-called religious right had so much influence in this past election, and how they themselves should quote-unquote try to appeal more to that segment of the Americana. So basically, one of the little KPFA shows, Against the Grain, with Ho Sia Sung, he had on two guests, Nakel Azmi and Peter Montgomery. And this dealt with how and what progressives should do about the hocus pocus influence in the election. Azmi goes on about the moral values cult, more or less, the quote unquote war of influence that is being spread by right-wing Christian Republicans for their own New Age manifest destiny. So we're going to deal with how some of these quote-unquote progressives are dealing with these issues, and then we're going to take it beyond the shadow and deal with how those of us who truly want some salvation in the world need to deal with it. So first off, let's see how they frame things, and then we'll take it from there. So check this out.
Ms. C.S. Song, according to one right-wing pundit, last Tuesday's election represented, quote, a clean sweep on marriage and morals. Now, there's no question that conservatives prevailed big time on the marriage issue. Voters in 11 states approved amendments to their constitutions that prohibit same-sex marriage. But has the right truly won the war over cultural values in this country? And if so, how? And what could or should the left have done or do now to counter the strategizing and organizing power of pro-GOP fundamentalist Christians? We have two guests today, both of whom have spent many years tracking the religious right. Nikhil Aziz is Associate Director of Political Research Associates, a group that works to expose and challenge the political right in this country. Nikhil's work focuses on the right's assault on the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender communities, as well as on immigrants and on communities of color. He joins us by phone from Somerville, Massachusetts. Welcome, Nikhil.
Thank you.
I'm also joined by Peter Montgomery. He's Vice President of Communications at People for the American Way, for which he has closely tracked the religious right for more than 10 years. Peter is in Washington, D.C. Welcome to you.
Thank you. It doesn't necessarily mean that someone who voted for, you know, who said moral values were important, were all people on the religious right. You know, people could be for a whole, against stem cell research, against gay marriage, and against, abortion, and say that they are for moral values. But people could be for all of those things. I mean, about almost 12% of liberals and 15% of non-church goers also reported that moral values were important for them, and they form part of the 22%.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think that figure is probably being, you know, that case is being overstated. And the other thing which is very interesting, I mean, I don't know about in terms of exit polling, but before the elections itself, there is the Institute for Applied Politics at the University of Akron, and they had come out with a study where they basically, and I think that makes more sense, to break down even evangelicals and Catholics and mainline Protestants in terms of whether they're traditionalist, centrist, or modernist. And if you look at the breakdown that way, it's a much more nuanced picture of even people who are religious, who go to church, who have strong, you know, positions and views on faith, are not all in the Republican camp, or are not all conservative. So I think it makes more sense. So for instance, traditionalist evangelicals, who are about 12.6% of the population, 70% of them identify as Republican, but 30% don't. And centrists and moderates, I mean modernists, you know, it actually goes the other way. There are more who identify as independent and or democratic than as Republican or conservative. So I mean, of course it's worrisome, but I don't think that this is, you know, that they won the culture war. I think it's certainly a war of values, a war of ideas that is ongoing, and it's, you know, it's, the jury is still out.
You know, what was going on in America and the world was not so crucial, this would be comical. But the mere fact that these clowns babble on and on about this whole moral values thing, which is basically a bourgeois construct, and it's within a bourgeois value system, is sickening. Because you have a situation where this becomes a fake horse race to try to appeal to the masses on some kind of artificial morality issue instead of emphasizing to the masses of the people their class interests, which has its own set of constructs that conform the basic moral basis of how a working class should go about a large part of their daily lives. About if you work full time, should you have enough to have food on the table for yourself and your family, health care, roof on the table, and money to develop yourself and your family in a culturally thriving way, you know, music, art, so on and so forth. Under the bourgeois model, no. As a matter of fact, you can have two or three jobs and that can be meaningless to them. Where's the morality in that? You know, so to get caught up in this whole moral thing, this is a trick by the ruling class, because what they want you and how they want you to look at thing is in a very personal, privatized way. You know, is this girl having sex before marriage and all of that type of stuff? It's all this Springer-esque type of rhetoric, as opposed to corporations that are running amok and committing war in the name of their particular profit. Now you got liberals talking about how they should bend their knees or appear to be bending their knees to some invisible man in a moral construct so that they can what? Get some immoral demagogue elected president as president of the United States? You know, look, the fact of the matter is that while they're talking about, and this shows you, this is how faith, because one thing, when you get caught up in all this whole thing, faith is not based in objectivity. Faith, as a matter of fact, crushes facts. That's what all of this attack against evolution. Here we are in the year 2004, in an industrialized, advanced society, and we got kooks running around saying that evolution doesn't exist. You know, it's just a theory. And they want it printed on the books, and they want teachers to come across not being, sounding solid in the facts that back them up, the scientific objective facts that back them up, that evolutionary is a fact of life, not just for humans, you know. But if you start trying to denounce evolution, there's a whole construct of how the world and planet has evolved that you're attacking. In essence, you are trying to deconstruct students from looking at things scientifically, from trying to be objective. So the Christian American, you know, whole thing is that a scientific objectivity should be overridden by some religious moral faith rhetoric, you know? And they push this type of stuff as a process of gumpifying down the population. And obviously it's worked on some liberals because instead of them talking about the fact that 32% of the trade union workers in America voted for Boy George and why they should not have more class conscious and should be breaking away from both the Democrats and Republicans, instead they're talking about how they should drop on their knees to appear more sympathetic, you know, and all of that. In other words, let's not deal with the concrete and deal with the masses in a concrete, objective way. Let's just play into this whole hocus-pocus posturing that the other demagogues, and of course, including them, are into.
What we're talking about here this evening, brothers and sisters, is how to fight the religious right and win. As Tracy just outlined, point number one in the program to defeat the religious right will be the promotion of science and knowledge. Now, it may sound like a joke, but if you see the state of our schools today, what is happening to the inner city schools, then you begin to understand one of the reasons that science and knowledge are not being promoted today. Quality education for all students, regardless of neighborhood or race. That becomes relevant because you cannot fend off this hocus pocus that Tracy's talking about unless you have something that's stronger than it. And what's stronger than religious hocus pocus? Knowledge, baby. Knowledge. Now, along with that program to promote science would be lessons and attacks on creationism as a theory. Yeah, you talk about a pseudo theory, but it's a theory very easy to defeat, by the way. One does not have to have more degrees than a thermometer to beat that bullshit down.
Longtime listeners can recall we actually had a debate with a creationist. And someone who is an advocate of the evolutionary process. You know, it was about, you know, 40-45 minute debate, and we went back and, you know, let them go back and forth and stuff, and dealt with it and stuff. That's how you deal with it.
Open, clear, out of position of these ideas. We counterpose truth to falsehood every time. Also, there is a need to form a militant anti-religious propaganda organization. Now, what am I talking about here? A lot of people don't know this, but there used to be the League of Atheists, used to be a popular organization in the United States, where they went around holding forums and seminars and other public events promoting the idea, oh, God forbid, that God doesn't exist. This is, people need to be able to go and hear this stuff. This, unfortunately, is going to fall to the small band of revolutionaries that still exist in this country. But it needs to happen. We need to have open dialogue about atheism here in America. And I'm not just talking about, you know, debating another left group. Well, I don't believe in God either, but I don't believe in God the way you don't believe in God. No. I'm talking about popular gatherings where we denounce these telemarket ministers and all this other madness. They're ripping people off, stealing their money, using the telephone, the television and the radio. I never will forget old Reverend Ike when I was growing up. Used to get on, and listen, this is on the radio. He'd say, you send me $1.25, and I'll send you a touch from God. I'll never forget that old foolishness with the prayer cloths. Used to send them the prayer cloth. Hey, let them do this stuff right on the radio, Tracy. Right on the radio. Now, how can one argue that that's legal? He gonna send you a prayer. Well, it's, man, just got a business, you know. Yeah, right. We need to start fighting this foolishness instead of crying about it the night after. And lastly, and most important, What we need is an organization, a workers' party that has a program, that is a system of demands that speak to the felt needs of the oppressed masses. Even these people walking around, and I'm talking many of them black, because being black, I hang with, you know, in the community. So many of them are black, and they be talking this old hocus pocus, oh, God didn't want man and woman to get, woman and woman to get married, some old foolishness. You know what? If they see an organization before them, beckoning them to struggle, to fight for what's really theirs, a decent education for their children, shorter hours at work with no loss in pay, so that everybody can go to work. When they see strong unions fighting for this, they'll drop that old hogwash so fast it'll blow your mind in a New York second.
And to back up some of the stuff that Gerald's saying is that if you read Huey P. Newton's article back in the 60s on or early 70s on homosexuality, and should the Panthers link up with homosexual groups, he unequivocally said yes. And he characterized them as a disenfranchised segment of the population that faces some of the issues that other oppressed people make. In other words, what happens is that when you are in motion, the communities are in motion, it's organized, people are kicking these, people then start to prioritize what's real and what isn't. When you got the hocus pokers out there demagoguing to you on Friday or Sunday nights, and they're chanting out of some old ancient book, Allah this, Jesus that, Moses this, and all of that type of stuff, and you're getting hammered over your head by the bosses and by the everyday issues of society, and you don't see anything else going on, then it's easier for the masses of the people to become susceptible to that jargon. But if you're engaged with the day-to-day struggle, all of that stuff, then you really start to see the light, and their significance starts to fade away when it comes to issues of clean water, and you start to see that you are making true changes in the schools, which has your kids become truly educated and literate, then all of a sudden the hocus pocus stuff loses its significance, which is exactly what they don't want.
In other words, when the masses of people are in struggle and in motion, their prejudices are dwarfed. They begin to take giant steps intellectually, and you'd be surprised at how quickly people can learn.
And part of that is because they start to see commonality, because the next thing they know, they're working with someone who's homosexual or whatever, didn't even know it, had all of these fantasies and illusions and stuff.
Prejudices.
Yeah, and the next thing you know, they're grinding with someone who's throwing down just as hard as they are, and trying to survive just like they are, and trying to get a raise from $7.80 an hour, to something livable and stuff.
Right.
But next, let's deal with how Sung asked Montgomery about whether the appeal of the conservative religious agenda. So let's see what they have to say next. Check this.
Peter Montgomery, for those people who are drawn to the conservative religious, conservative Christian agenda, is it as simple as saying that the appeal of that agenda is simply due to the fact that people like thinking that things ought to stay the way they are, that they have a sense perhaps of nostalgia about the way they think families used to be organized? Is it as simple as that?
I think that's probably a little simplistic, and I think that a little simplified. I think that again, even within the Christian right, it's not monolithic, and I think it's hard to sort of ascribe one motivation. I think it's clear that there are a large number of people who are not comfortable with the visibility in the media of gay people and gay rights, and there's a whole there was a whole huge campaign that was whipped up by religious right leaders and networks of pastors in megachurches around the country around the gay marriage issue. And that was a motivator. That was for people who just, you know, for them, that's sort of one step too far. You know, they might be willing to put up with you know, Will and Grace on TV, but they don't want, you know, Will to get married. So there was a, you know, a really intensive organizing through networks of conservative churches and pastors and you know, large, well-funded organizations like Focus on the Family lent their muscle to that. But again, I think that I also agree that this election does not mean that the religious right moral agenda has carried the day with most Americans. And the fact, one of the startling things is if you look at some of the Gallup polling and other polling that's come out since the election, you know, the more majority of the people still don't agree with President Bush on a lot of issues. It's just he got more than half because there was a number of people in the middle there who, while they didn't agree with him on some things, trusted him better on terror than they trusted John Kerry. And I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind when we start really picking apart these claims that the right is making, that this was all decided on moral values. The right really wants to make that claim because then it gives them, you know, this sort of real perceived power to sort of, you know, demand things from the president and from the Congress. And they are doing that already. You know, they have made, they're sort of saying, we won you the election, and there's no doubt that they were an important part of Bush's victory. And they're, you know, demanding right-wing justices at the Supreme Court. They're demanding action on the constitutional amendment on marriage. They're pushing for more censorship of the media, including, you know, extending FCC control to cable and satellite for broadcast. So they have a political agenda that they're going to move, and they're going to use their important part in the Bush electoral victory as part of staking their claim to that. But I think it's also important for people to read some of the analysis that's coming out that's looking a little more closely at that, and that this was not, this election was not, you know, a huge victory for the religious right social agenda.
See, what's sad about this is that they're approaching this whole thing once again as some kind of horse race. And that's because these weak liberals see the Democrats as the true option. They have just as much illusion and faith in the Democrats as the hocus pocusers do about some invisible man in the sky.
Right.
So they can't differentiate the fact that these guys are using this whole moral values things as a tactic to, amongst other things, as a wedge within the ruling class to divide it up and to have it think in the same way they use ethnic divisions, you know, in Rwanda and all of that type of stuff, to help divide up the masses and to look at one another, you know, across the farm as being the polar opposites. Both of them are starving. Both of them are fighting over the last piece of a potato. But one's a Tutu and the other is a Tutsi and another is a Hutu. So they're up there thinking that they're on some completely opposite, polar opposites of the world, while the IMF is pimping them all. In other words, what I'm saying is that these little weak liberals are playing into this whole thing, and which is just what the rulers want. So Bush, as he said, got more than half of the vote, apparently, you know, with all this voter fraud, who knows. But, you know, but based on that, many of the people said it's because they felt Bush was stronger on war and on terror. Yet, here we have a thing where the morality of the rulers that Bush represents, that produced Abu Ghraib, that produced the manufacturing of the whole weapons of mass destruction, the whole aspect of what happened with Valerie Plame, the CIA agent, who because her husband didn't come back from Niger and say what the Republicans wanted him to say concerning the Niger uranium Iraq connection, they release her name out through Robert Novak.
Right.
You know, he's a little pundit. So that's how her name gets exposed, and that basically ruins her career. Now, I don't care. I wouldn't care if she got her ass shot off. But what I'm saying is for all of those who believe in this system, what kind of morality base is this? Especially when those within this administration are still playing games, are still playing games and pretending like they don't know what the hell is going on and who released what. This shows how, once again, how sick this whole process is. Then you also have a situation where it's clear that the person who released the anthrax all over the country, you know, after the 9/11 hit, it's clear that that was produced in America at Ames Laboratory, and that it had a basis somewhere within those who have connections within you know, the system. The Bush administration has basically dragged its feet on those particular issues. What kind of morality is that? That they would just play around with that? You know, in other words, the whole construct of this whole morality thing, that those who latch on to Boy George or claim that's why they're latching on to, is a false construct. And that whole construct should be attacked.
Right.
But you can't attack it if you're trying to hold on to the other wing of the administrators for the ruling class, the Democrats.
That's right.
Because their moral foundation is also based and predicated off of the ruling classes also. Now, to give you an example, you know, often you hear these guys talk, you know, like when black people in America talk about reparations, you know, get off your knees, get, you know, and all of this type of stuff. You don't deserve work for yours and all of this. You know, recently, U.S. taxpayers paid $270 million in reparations. To who? For what? This was for lost profits to corporations. Halliburton, Shell, Mobile, Pepsi,
oh,
Nestle,
man.
Kentucky Fried Chicken,
oh,
Toys R Us.
Oh, no.
What could I be talking about? This was part of a $125 billion sovereign debt. This was also through the whole structural adjustment program. Who were the people hit for this? Reparations pay? The people of Iraq. Because the U.S. empire goes to war against the people of Iraq. Because that's who it was against, the people of Iraq. Forget all this, you know, smokescreen stuff with Saddam. And then, since the U.S. corporations say, look, since the war started, which of course we were backing, this has cut into our profits because the people who used to buy our Kentucky Fried Chicken are getting blown up. So we want our monies. So, of course, that's what ends up happening. They get their monies through some kind of reparations. It wasn't U.S. taxpayer. Well, in part it was because of the bullets and stuff, you know, that goes and blows up the Iraqi people. So it's the taxpayer money for the missiles that are blowing up in Iraq. And then it comes out of the Iraqi people in reparations through the form of structural adjustment to pay for these hoodlum corporations. Now, nowhere in this provision does it say that the workers who work, who are all Iraqi, you know, you work in it for Toys R Us and all of that, you know, in Iraq, nowhere they're not paid, you know, for this type of stuff, you know, if they're still alive. This all goes to the corporations. Now, what kind of morality base is this? It's a corporate moral base.
Thank you.
And that's what both sides represent.
Right. All right, look here, man. Let's look at this from another angle, because I think it's very important. First of all, Tracy was talking about the illusions in this hocus-pocus Republican, you know, whatever you want to call this matchup they got with the religious right. Well, that's only one illusion. Now, he spoke about, in fact, the other illusions that people have in the Democrats, that the Democrats were going to be some kind of force to protect the working people, to do good things, etc., whatever. The fact of the matter is, if you want to fight and destroy the religious right, that's what I want to do. Let's not, you know, come on. Destroy. Wipe off the face of the earth. And I'm not talking about killing people who have these false views. I'm talking about undermining these views so that no one will give them credence. That's how you destroy something like the religious right. Well, you cannot effectively fight illusions with illusions. You can't fight the illusions that these right-wingers have with to have illusions in the Democrats. That's ridiculous. It's ineffective. It's not going to work. You fight illusions with what Tracy just did, with exposures of the criminal government and government officials and thieving capitalists, the rapacious capitalists. That's how you expose the difference between the, in fact, impoverished in Americans, you know, working class base of this Christian coalition on the one hand, and the filthy rich capitalists who they work in the interest of, inadvertently, of course. They don't even know they're working in their interest. But that's how you do it. You don't fight illusions with illusions. You fight illusions with exposures of these criminals, be they government criminals or corporate criminals. You don't fight these illusions with more illusions in the Democrats. You fight these illusions that these poor religious people have with the truth about which way forward out of this mess. How do we fight our way out of this crisis in a language that the working people can understand? And above all, you fight against these illusions, not with illusions, but by organizing a real fight, as I described earlier. You see, that's what we got to get with. Now, a part of this thing also, let me tell you, timing is a part of it. Timing is very important in politics. And to be honest with you, I did think at the time, you know, people were running back and forth with the, doing the little marriage, gay marriage thing, that it was kind of taking a third-rate story and pushing it all up front, when it really didn't have a lot to do with, you know, the improvement of the lives of most people in America. There's nothing wrong with two gay people getting married, but let's put it in perspective. Is that the most important thing on the order of the day for the working class? That gay people get married? No, we're going to have to put that where it belongs. For instance, that's not as important as the education of our children, is it? No, it is not. I'll say it. That's not important whether or not people have jobs. No, it is not. But they play these liberals. They let them put that all up there to make these poor, ignorant religious fanatics think that that was the real issue in America today. And those very people ain't got no damn jobs. They're from the areas of the country, in most cases, where they're suffering from unemployment of more than 30 to 40% in America. So let's think. How do we destroy this Christian coalition?
And you know, in a Gumpified society, and a Gumpified media system, they're going to play into this being a sexy issue, you know, because they know that it tugs at certain people to see these types of quote-unquote things going on. Just in the same way that they just played up this whole Peterson case. Just kept on and on and on and on.
Oh, man.
You have to see these things for what they are. And then, especially when, you know, like when Court TV first started, I wasn't against the whole Court TV, you know, because for the most part, even though the pundits would come on and try to spin it, they couldn't spin it too far, because for the most part,
you were seeing.
You know, so when you see and watch the OJ trial, it didn't matter what they were saying. You had witnessed it or heard it on the radio yourself, so you had your own opinion, and you can easily decipher and call them on it, because they often would have call-in stuff. They changed that whole format now, and now basically Court TV is set up where they have these little pundits, often just right-wing clappers. And they come in, they go and watch the trial, and then they come in and tell you what they want you to hear and feel about the case. And often they're diatribing on and on in a way that is designed to get you riled up.
Precisely.
You know, where, like in the OJ case, where, you know, it was clear, no matter what you thought about OJ's guilt or innocence, and one thing was clear beyond a shadow of a doubt, that the police fabricated some of the evidence. A clear example of that, right quick, is that when Dennis Fung is the you know, one of the collectors, and he claimed that he found the infamous socks, OJ socks, on the throwaway rug that later were to have OJ's blood, Nicole's, you know, blood, you know, on down the line, and Goldman's blood on it. Now, what happened, though, in trial was that Cochran and them got up, and they showed him a videotape during the court, and they said, you know what this is? And he goes, oh, yeah, this is when, you know, fairly wealthy people, when we investigate their homes, since there's so many valuables, a videographer goes in and videotapes the whole house first, you know, just in case important items are missing, we have a record and stuff. And he gives him the list, and he goes, so could you tell us when this guy was in? And it showed that the guy, and it was a whole list, and you write in when you came in, you know, and the guy was clearly there before him. And then they got the video camera and showed it. And then it showed the time he was in, and he was in before Dennis Fung was in. The collector was in. So the videographer was there first. And then the various people came in, you know, analyzed this and that. And Fung came in, and it showed on the list when he came in, you know, much later. Well, they showed the videography, and it goes past the throwaway rug. No socks.
Uh-huh.
So he, so Sheck turns to him and says, where are they? Where are they, Mr. Fung? You know, so all the so-called evidence about the blood on the socks in the juror's mind vanquished, because the socks were not where the, Dennis Fung much later took the picture showing them.
I got it.
I mean, it just blew their whole, that whole aspect, and put suspicion in people's mind. Then the Sox came, case became worse, because then it turned out that in the exam room, both the defense scientific team and the prosecuting scientific team looked at the Sox and other material, and they both discarded the Sox because they said there's nothing there. Then the defense gets a call back months later and says, we found something. They go, what? And they go, we found blood. Nicole's, OJ's, Ronald Goldman's blood. So all of a sudden, they check. And now there's a big old spot of, that somehow they all missed before. So, of course, the defense is suspicious. So they test the blood. And they find that it has EDTA, which is a preservative. Now, you have EDTA in your blood normally, but the EDTA that was in there is at a level that's not normal, because that's when you take it out and put it in a vial to preserve it and stuff. The jurors said, we can't trust these fools.
That's right.
You know, so in other words, what I'm saying is they don't want that type of stuff to go on.
Ooh,
and, you know,
no.
They just want you to just be droned down, you know, and just, oh, whatever they say, you know, that
yeah.
type of stuff.
No, and just to add a little bit to what Tracy's just saying, it is my honest consideration that this whole Peterson thing was done in order to further regiment people along the lines of that Christian Coalition BS. Why? Because they say not only did this, what they call, adultery.
Right.
Adulterer.
Yeah.
He was an adulterer. Not only was he an adulterer, but he killed the unborn, child. And therefore, there's a special place in heaven for all y'all adultering, murdering your own babies in the womb.
Well, he was also convicted of that.
Well, yeah,
too.
Well, it's two murders. Only one person killed two murders. So look, get this, though. And this came out, and everywhere I go, people, you know, they come to me and say, well, what do you think about Peterson? I said, first of all, I don't that much, to be honest with you, because, well, there's been little things like the war in Iraq has been going on, and, you know, and I was...
Sudan, Ivory Coast, the Congo.
I was trying to build a million workers march. There's all kind of stuff going on. I ain't got time for nobody to be programming me with they BS. But the truth of the matter is, looks like they just sent an innocent man to prison, to me. And I'm not defending him. I'm not saying what he may or may not have done. But I'm saying that by the evidence provided by the prosecution, there's no proof that that man killed his wife. You can't say that a man killed his wife because he went out and got some Twilo. Now you stop and think about that. If everybody that got some Twilo, and then something happened to your wife, that automatically makes you guilty. Ooh-wee! Fellas. And I don't want to say ladies, because I don't want to cause no problems out there. But y'all know your ladies, y'all be quantetting it and quintetting it and carrying on. Listen here. That's not proof of guilt. Some people actually have what's called a life and enjoy that life to the fullest. And wherever it takes you, baby. Enjoy it. You know? Forget all that old madness and, you know, listen. That don't make that man guilty. The fact that he may have had a very nasty personal character, maybe, I don't know the man. That don't make that man guilty. The fact that, you know, they didn't find one. You know, what are the elements upon which you can convict people? Do you know my aunt told me today? Well, can't you convict people on circumstantial evidence? Auntie, Lord have mercy, bless you. Thank you, Jay, for saying that, because at least it's in her mind. And that means it's in the mind of millions. You are not supposed to convict people on circumstantial evidence. You are, if you convict somebody beyond what? A reasonable doubt. That means that you are supposed to have a few things. I'm going to mention three of them. One, hard evidence. That is, unequivocal proof that there was some wrongdoing and that this person was involved. Two, you've got to have witnesses. You know? So, the first thing, hard evidence, murder weapon, something like that. Two, witnesses. Three, confession. If you ain't got none of that, you ain't got a damn case. It ain't even supposed to be in a court of law. But that just shows you how far and how deep America has sunk. Which way, America?
Next, AZ goes into who's part of the Christian right in America, for all its worth. Check it out.
Nikhil, please weigh in here.
Yeah, I agree with Peter entirely. I mean, there is that tendency, I think, on the part of the left and on the part of progressives and liberals in general also to kind of ascribe those sort of country bumpkin, rural, redneck, you know, names and name calling for a lot of the people on the Christian right, which of course doesn't serve to do anything else but make them even more opposed to you and to your views, and confirm them, you know, confirm their belief that you're, you know, that you look down on them, and those kinds of things. So I think Peter's entirely right. I mean, and apart from the fact that, you know, that you find people who are affluent and lawyers and doctors and engineers and even scientists who are part of this whole coalition, I mean, the thing is, too, that there are some surveys which say that close to 45 to 50% of people identify in some way as evangelical or born again. So that's almost half the country, or even more. But are they all part of the Christian right? No, not necessarily, right? So I really think it one has to have a much more nuanced view of lens in terms of what people's makeup is and why they vote a certain way, or who, you know, what makes them the Christian right.
Well, I think you just made an important point, too, about evangelical Christians. Some in the media have started using that term as interchangeable with the religious right or the Christian right, basically because, you know, some people like Ralph Reed said, well, they don't like the term Christian right. They want, but it's really, Christian right is a more appropriate term when you're talking about a political movement with political leaders and political goals. An evangelical Christian is a religious term that includes a lot of people who are progressive and middle of the road politically, so I mean, I understand why religious right political leaders would rather be referred to that way, because then they sort of get all the, you know, moral and religious, they sort of get to claim the whole banner of evangelical Christianity. But that's a bad shorthand, and we should work on trying to get media not to use that shorthand, and to differentiate between people who are Christians, which cuts all across political spectrum, and, you know, people who are part of this sort of organized political movement that's based in Christian, in conservative Christian churches and organizations.
So once again, even their little definition and understanding of what this is all about, and how it is a wedge and gumpification measure, is just completely whacked and out of the, you know, all this, you know, people are part of the Christian right, you know, you have some of those who are progressive and middle of the road. Middle of what road? I mean, look, as people have heard in my commentary, the war on women's reproduction freedoms, the links are clear. I outline how this Christian right movement has played a role in doing bombings of health clinics. They have instruction manuals to assassinate doctors, abortion-giving doctors, and cut the thumbs off of them. Yet, just because they drop on their knees and pray to some invisible man, then suddenly they have some kind of moral credibility, and you can't be too harsh on them.
That's
great. I mean, this is silly. This is sickening. But see, this shows how these little liberals' minds are eroded from class consciousness, and they get caught up into this whole, what can we do to appeal to them? In other words, coddle this type of nonsense. You know, this is the same thing that kind of in part helped set them up, this whole faith-based concept. In the same way that these Christian right types have their faith in their invisible man, and a lot of, hocus-pocus Islamers have faith in their invisible man, and Hebrews have their faith, you know, and on and on and on, it's the same way that liberals have their faith-based concept in the Democrats, in some kind of unholy type of way. You know, it was kind of comical to see liberals during this election, because they said, look, we're not going to take this no more. We're going to monitor Nader and make sure he doesn't spoil this election. And then they said, we're going to monitor the election booths and make sure those Republicans don't monitor or don't steal this election from us. the one person that they didn't monitor correctly and set up a self-defense for because they had illusion in them was Carrie. And he's the one who copped out on him, even though he said that he would count all the votes and all of this stuff.
The one person
who dropped out was Nader. I mean, it was Carrie, and he's the one person they didn't have anything set up for. They could have had these little liberals a thing set up that if Carrie drops out, just like Gore did last year, or in the year 2000, we'll have commissions ready to keep the whole energy alive and keep people organized and on the thing and keep the whole pressure groups, you know, and set up so that we'll keep pushing this issue until there's some accountability. And have been, you know, you have this one place where people came to vote and only like 680 something were registered. Carrie gets like 200 votes and Boy George gets over 4,000. Obviously, there were some shenanigans, but since they didn't have anything set up to monitor Carrie and a defense squad for the people they say they represent, just in case Carrie copped out, because they have so much faith in the Democrats, the one element that they weren't prepared to cop out did. And that's how they got, you know, basically a Democrat feces on their face. This is sad, especially when this happened in the last presidential election. There's no excuse. There's a certain illogic and disconnect to it, almost like a faith-based disconnect, in the same way that they're talking about the religious right having their kind of faith. These guys have an unequivocal faith in the Democrats in the same way that some of these little, you know, hocus pocusers in these Abrahamic traditions have in their little invisible mans. Now that's sad.
Yeah, it is. But people got to remember, we got to stay focused on this stuff. As I say, education is indeed the key. But they talk about their morals. Oh, you ain't, two gay people ain't supposed to get married. That's the worst thing in the world. Yeah, that's the worst thing in the world. How about locking people up at work and not letting them go home to their families? You know, a lot of women have to acquire babysitters when they're working late. And if y'all recall, here at Slave Revolt, you heard it. We talked about Walmart locking up their employees at 8 o'clock and not paying them no overtime and having them work 1 to 2 more hours. They finally got sued and lost $50 million on this case. But just on an ethical basis, what kind of Christianity some ignorant people using here? Is that wrong to lock people up against their will and not let them go home to their children after they done worked the full 8-hour day? To keep them against their will? Is there any right and wrong here? What kind of morals? See, they got their morals. Their little hocus pocus that they throw, where they throw the dust in your face and confuse you. And we got ours. Their morals tell you that the rich people got every damn thing, and the Lord told you that's the way it's supposed to be. So get on your knees and be grateful you're alive. That's their morals in a nutshell. Ours is that the earth belongs to the people that inhabit it, y'all. And we can do anything on this planet that we can accomplish in a collective way if our consciousness rises to the occasion. All things that are good for the working people, that unite us and strengthen us, are good. You see? Now I get some old silly time liberals say to me, oh, you revolutionary, you for violence. They actually had a KPFA, I couldn't believe this, man, a little forum about nonviolent communication. They out of their mind. These people have lost their minds. I'm not kidding you. It was the Coalition for Democratic Pacific.
And most of them probably voted for Kerry.
Every one of them.
Now, during the election time, I didn't hear Kerry do any nonviolent communication. He said that we're going to kill all the terrorists.
Kill, kill, kill.
Which basically meant people throughout the Middle East, Africa, and Latin America.
Be prepared. Set up brown people. Kill,
right,
kill, kill.
You know, he said that he is going to extend the war. in Iraq.
Kill, kill, kill some more, more, more.
He said that he was going to penetrate the Taliban and other entities in Afghanistan. Kill, kill, kill some more. In other words, every aspect of...
That's for the Lord. He was killing for the Lord there. That, I guess that's
every aspect of Kerry's agenda basically was a kill 'em up agenda. Of course,
absolutely,
it was for the ruling class
sector. Trying to keep up with Bush.
Right.
With
so if you yards. Were voting, if you voted for Kerry, you voted
for kill, kill, kill.
And the program of kill, because that's what it's all about. So to then turn to other people who are saying, well, wait a minute. Maybe it's not us that should be doing all the dying. Maybe it's not, it shouldn't be just our people in our communities and people who are in the same class category as us throughout the world on this giant Indian reservation that should be dying. Maybe the system that is based around kill, kill, kill should itself die out. Maybe the people of Haiti should not
help it out.
Right. But if you're for, if you were for Kerry, you're on that side of the agenda.
That's right.
See, this whole religious thing, they're using religion.
That's right.
As a political tool, because it is a political tool.
Always the, has been.
The whole moral value construct is a bourgeois, in a bourgeois marketing context, is a social political construct designed to benefit
right.
the property class.
Exactly.
Now, during, you know, in 1995, the Southern Baptist Convention apologized. What did they apologize for? They apologized for their role in helping construct the Civil War. What I mean by this is that, you know, they were founded in 1845, the whole Southern Baptist Convention in the South, and they were designed to defend slavery as biblically sanctioned. That's what they did. They helped give rise simultaneously to the Confederacy concept and the Southern Baptist Convention at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Southern ministers built antebellum Southern churches throughout the region and and the whole Confederacy concept. And during that time in 1845, both the North and South generally supported slavery and white supremacy, but the Southern ministers described the South as God's country alone. They got into that whole, you know, this, you know, Osama before there was Osama with a Christian twist.
Mm-hmm.
They said that the South was the sacred nation, the sacred area. And they called the Civil War, when the Civil War broke out, a holy crusade.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in 1860...
is on our side, maybe?
Oh, without the DeBow Review. This is one of the little, you know, Southern Christian churches. I mean, papers at the time and stuff. They said that, quote, many causes will contribute to our happiness as a separate nation. But preeminently in view stands two peculiar... features. The one is pure religion, the other is a perfect legal system. In religious sentiments, the South stands as a unit. Its pure doctrines are linked inseparably, though not by legal constraint, with the laws of land. Christ is acknowledged as the common bond of the Union. In other words, they were trying to, and they did, biblically and socially and all this whole, you know, moral values type of stuff, they
garbage.
Set the whole tone for this kind of manifest destiny sanction type stuff in the South that you still see exist today, where people flying their little Confederate flags and so proud of that, even though it obviously stands into contradictions to many people in the South who are nationalistic, you know, and got, you know, and wave the American flag today, and stand for the unity and all this love it or leave it type of stuff. Yet at the same time, they're waving the Confederate flag too, which obviously was some part of the nation that broke off from the Union. How could they do that without having some form of dual consciousness? Part of that is the hocus pocus stuff that was sanctioned and deeply embedded into them, that the South was doing a holy righteous thing. And that kind of furor still exists today. And is deeply embedded into that. I mean, there were all types of preeminent figures in the South who became like top zealots, like you see the little Christian right of today, who were part of the whole Southern Baptist Convention. There was a whole little confederation and stuff that morally sanctioned this stuff. They had their whole own charters and everything. This just my whole point in pointing this out is that many of these people in the South were living like hell, you know, and uneducated at a high level and stuff like that. But since they were hocus pocusized, and they came to believe that if God sanctioned slavery and the whole slaveocracy system and the whole system of white supremacy, who are we to challenge it?
Yeah, buddy. You know what, though? I got to say, when they start to bring in that God is on my side in with the slavery stuff, I'm going to have to repeat the words of my man Phil Oaks. What's that beautiful line he said? Yeah, in those type of churches where they preaching that kind of racist filth, he said, the solemn face of Jesus is choking in the dust. And their members go around frothing at the mouth like mad dogs at their Sunday morning lusts. He said, and that silver cross done turned to a cross that cake with dust. And heaven only knows in which God they can trust.
One would be surprised if one examines honestly, the role of the Arab Islamic slave trade in Africa and how that whole holy crusade into the southern and the northern and northern eastern parts of Africa and the destruction of many of the civilizations through the Islamic slave trade, like Nubia and other places, how much of that was based in this kind of religious furor and stuff. And the type of justification and denouncement of black people that started to come into place when black people resisted, from the Zanj Rebellion, the type of racist literature that was coming out by many of the Islams when black people resisted the slave trade and stuff, as them being racially inferior and stuff like that, and the type of zealotry that this often spawned off. You know, many people know that, you know, for all, you know, black people love talking about the Moors, you know, being down with the Moors, look what they accomplished. Now, I've always hated the Moors myself. I don't care that they invented aspirin and all of that, because my historical view is the chain reaction that they set off. First of all, the Spaniards weren't messing with nobody. They were just some little people kind of isolated, not doing nothing. The Moors, who were primarily black, you know, Guanabani Moors, and then you had some Tuani, what we'll call Tuani Moors, who were basically Arabs, but the core crust of them were black, and they went into Spain, conquered it for 800 years. Yes, they added many of the technologies and, you know, paved roads and this and that, but they basically conquered an indigenous people. That's what they did, and they dominated them for 800 years. And like any other indigenous people, those people, you know, set off a chain reaction. But what got implemented in the Spaniards was a lot of the seeds of religious justification for expansionism and imperial types of mindsets and on and on. So what happened? In 1491, the Moors finally get kicked out of Spain by the Spaniards. 1 year later, 1492, Columbus sails the Ocean Blue. Not only he has a Christian lens on, because that's how they were able to resist, and now they take the Spaniards' take to the New World the same type of religious justification and fear that had been thrust onto them by the Islamic Moors, and the world's never been the same. There would have been no there wouldn't have been no Christopher Columbus if there had not been the Moors conquering into Spain and feeding them that not only technology but that whole hocus pocus justification mindset.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. So these things have to be looked at for what they really are.